Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
This week, the Liberals unveiled a 32-point plan for reforming the government. It includes proposals on everything from changing our elections to altering question period. Liberal leader Justin Trudeau is here to discuss his plan and the controversial Bill C-51, which is now officially law.
Another senator is wrapped in scandal. Don Meredith is accused of having a sexual relationship with a teenage girl. There are now calls for him to resign, and we speak with Senator Jim Munson about the story and the reputation of the Senate.
The House of Commons has risen for summer break on a day when Industry Minister James Moore surprised everyone by bowing out of federal politics. Altogether, there are more than 50 MPs who won't be returning in the fall, and one respected member of Parliament, Conservative James Rajot, sits down for an exit interview with political editor Paul Wells.
We also speak with Elections Canada about the changes you need to know about before the fall election, and the McLean's panel discusses the summer campaign and new details about the McLean's leaders debate.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
What we need is real change. And leadership that fixes what Stephen Harper has broken.
That's Liberal leader Justin Trudeau, who this week announced a sweeping 32-point Democratic reform plan for what he says will be real change in Ottawa. The Liberals are hoping this news gives them a positive boost after a spring that's seen the leader and his party sliding in the polls. This Democratic reform package from the Grits includes proposals on everything from improving question period to banning partisan government ads.
But Trudeau's biggest new promise is to get rid of Canada's so-called first-past-the-post election system, in which the candidate with the most votes in every riding gets to be MP and the loser gets nothing. Trudeau promises to study alternatives like proportional representation and ballots where voters rank the candidates. He wants to bring in a new system within 18 months of winning power. A few hours after he made his Democratic reform speech, Justin Trudeau spoke to McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes on Parliament Hill. They also discussed the controversial Bill C-51, which received royal assent on Thursday. John got the wide-ranging interview rolling by asking Trudeau what makes him think Canadians are primed to fundamentally change the way they elect MPs.
I think as we look at declining voter turnout, as we look at people increasingly aware that a majority government was given to a party that 60% of Canadians not only didn't vote for, but actively tend to dislike. There's real question about how we're valuing our votes. And what it comes down to me, is something I've talked about an awful lot, that when you have politics done by division, by wedge issues, by attacks and negativity, it actually becomes really difficult to govern responsibly for the whole. So the more people disengage from politics, the worse the quality, not just of our public discourse and debate, but of the actual policies put forward. And that's underlining pretty much the whole package we put forward today, that open and transparent government is better government. But specifically around reforms, I think people have reached a point where, we want to have a real opportunity to make our votes count.
So a couple of follow-ups to that. One is, the NDP has been for proportional representation now for quite a long time. So if I'm a voter who's tired of first past the post and looking for a champion of some reform, why would I turn to the Liberal Party that's coming to this position now? Why wouldn't I think, well, the New Democrats have been in favor of an alternative to that for a long time? Why aren't they the natural champion of that type of reform?
I think one of the suspicions that people have around electoral reform, and we saw it in a wariness in the Fair Unfair Elections Act that the Conservatives put forward, there's a sense that that parties put forward positions that are in their own self-interest.
Right.
I mean, seeing the Green Party talk about proportional representation is not illegitimate as a position, but you understand where it really makes
you fear
difference
the Green Party just thinks we can get some more.
Yeah, rightly or wrongly, that's the perception that people tend to have around positions like this. So, we want to make sure that there is all party, open debate, discussion, drawing on experts, looking at international models, making sure that we're actually digging into what's the best for Canada in terms of moving forward, and not what's best for a particular party that happens to wield power at this particular moment and could set the rules for perhaps a generation to come. And that you know, desire to make a responsible process, open and transparent and consult, is part of why we voted against the NDP's motion a few months ago, because they said, this is the actual position, this is the best solution, and this is what the country should do. And we've said, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but there needs to be a responsible, open debate that includes everyone in it, and that's the difference.
And would that culminate in a plebiscite of some sort?
We've committed to strong, open consultations. What they exactly will look like, we'll see. But you know, it hasn't gone unnoticed by people that electoral reform has had a lot of trouble getting through plebiscites.
So the whole tone of what you've laid out in various, from various angles today, is for a less rigid, more sort of democratic, maybe more flexible sort of process in the House of Commons with respect to the Senate, even with respect to the way we elect members of Parliament, which to me raises another kind of question. Like, if the idea is we shouldn't feel so stuck behind the ideas of party loyalties, a rigid concept of how the House of Commons works, I'm wondering how you're going to handle things if the Kayne voters don't hand you a clear majority. What is your thinking right now on coalitions, cooperation, some kind of agreement that would allow a minority parliament to function for a while? I mean, after all, it's looking like a horse race these days. How would you function after the election day?
First of all, I am very, very both impressed and inspired by the kinds of conversations I have with Canadians across the country. People are very sophisticated in their concerns about various parties, in their hopes for what the next government's going to look like. And I'm not going to prejudge any possible outcomes. But I do know that people are, by and large, really open to a change, open to having a different Prime Minister than Mr. Harper, specifically because there's a need for a different tone, a different approach, a different style of government and governance. And that's something that I've laid forward today. Now, part of that is, as I've said throughout, a level of respect for experts and other parliamentarians and working together to make things happen. And that's something that I'll absolutely do. And the Liberal Party has always worked with multiple parties in the House to make sure that we're being governed in the best interest of Canadians. But I won't short-circuit the democratic process by telling Canadians that, well, a vote for X actually means a Y government or what have you. I'm not going to reduce the choices at the ballot box for Canadians by, you know, backroom deals or secret arrangements. I think that's a cause for cynicism more than anything else amongst Canadians.
Does the party that gets the most seats have to form the government of Canada?
You're asking me a question about our foundational principles in Parliament. The fact is, the party that can command the confidence of the House gets to form the government, and that's always been the tradition, and that will continue to be the tradition.
You say you would repeal parts of the Anti-Terrorism Act. What parts would you repeal?
The overly broad definitions that aren't specifically targeting. We have managed to make a change on lawful, removing the word lawful from protest in a number of amendments. But there have been a number of issues highlighted throughout, and we have actually we're about to put forward a long and comprehensive proposal that will go exactly to the changes we're going to.
Oh, that's coming in
the coming days, absolutely.
I won't ask you to scoop that announcement, but it'll include what? What you like and what you don't like spelled out?
It'll primarily talk about the amendments that we would have liked to have seen to this one and the kinds of changes we bring in. But the big one is a narrowing and limiting of the kinds of new powers that CSIS and national security agencies would have, bringing in of a mandatory review clause every 3 years, the way we did around 2001, to make that so that we know that we're actually doing the right kinds of things, even as we look at it unfolds, And then the big one, bringing in oversight by parliamentarians of all our national
a committee that would be sworn in some way to
absolutely
our national
high level of secrecy, the very similar to what happens in our other Five Eyes allies.
Right.
But the one thing I will point out about C-51 is that it has become an extraordinarily polarized debate.
It has, yeah.
The Liberal Party is doing what I am committed to in governance and in Parliament, regardless of the difficulty of a situation, which is take a responsible position. We have said clearly there are elements in there that increase the safety of Canadians in an immediate way.
Which elements are those?
Well, the preventative arrests, the strengthening of the no-fly lists, and the better coordination and communication between agencies. Those will have an immediate impact. There's even been talking that if those had been in place ahead of Saint-Jean sur Richelieu, it might not have happened. Who knows? You know,
yeah,
could have shut up. But there is a sense shared amongst the majority of the witnesses that those three elements in particular increase safety for Canadians in a concrete way. Now, there's also no argument that there is a lot of other things in there that we do have concerns about, and I've highlighted a number of them and will continue to.
Hmm.
And that's where we made amendments. The bill was actually changed to a certain extent along the lines of some of our amendments, and why we are committed to repealing and replacing those elements. Now, Mr. Mulcair chose to vote against the measures that do concretely increase security for Canadians.
Well, he voted against the whole bill, right? He didn't vote against those measures.
He chose to resist the bill. I'm not going to go around saying that he doesn't care about the safety of Canadians. He's putting Canadians in danger, because that, quite frankly, is an irresponsible style of politics.
Mm.
I don't think after 10 years of divisiveness and attacks from Mr. Harper, that we need to be attacking each other on the opposition side when we're in agreement that there's tremendous problems with the bill, even though there are some good elements in the bill. We made a decision to say, I'm not going to vote against Canadians' physical security, and I'm going to make sure that we're upholding the rights and freedoms that are so dear to Liberals and to Canadians if we form government.
Hmm.
Mr. Mulcair has made a different decision on that. The fact that he's playing up the fear for Aboriginal Canadians, environmental groups, and Muslims, the way Mr. Harper is playing up fears of terrorism, is quite frankly polarizing and bringing out down our debate in a way that I...
Isn't that, though, the traditional role of opposition leaders to, if you have a piece of legislation that does have, as you've said, it does have fundamental, like serious flaws in it, I can't think of a parallel where an opposition leader in my time covering the Hill would have said, you know, I see major problems with legislation. However, I'm going to support it anyway. I mean, it's relatively uncommon for opposition parties to vote for the government in significantly divisive bills like this anyway, let alone when you're actually declaring we don't like these big parts of it.
I think when it comes down to issues of national security, when it comes down to issues of Canadians actually being safe or not, there is a desire by Canadians that political parties not play politics.
Mm.
And I will take the criticism that after 10 years of Stephen Harper's style of doing things, people must think me overly generous to not try to play politics on an issue as important as this. But I know from the conversations I've had with Canadians across the country that they do know that we need both. We need to both protect Canadians' physical safety and uphold our rights and freedoms. And the Liberal Party, through its experience since 2001 and bringing in the measures that we did then, like I have during my leadership, being unequivocal about my support for Muslim communities, going to mosques despite all the attacks from the Conservative Party, and positions of being strongly in support of the Charter, I, quite frankly, and this is maybe where I made a strategic or a calculation error, I didn't really think that people would be so divisive and so aggressive as to somehow make it seem like the Liberal Party doesn't care about the Charter. And perhaps I am overly idealistic about how government should work, but when I see Mr. Mulcair stoking up fears, the same way Mr. Harper has made a career, a very successful career out of it, I have to say, you know what? That's not what Canadians want from their leadership. That's not what they want from their government.
Going back quite a while now in your leadership, I've thought that the theme you wanted to hit the hardest was middle class prosperity. Questions about the economy, but focused on people sort of in the middle. Today, you have a big sweeping 32-point plan for democratic reform, and that comes after what I believe has been a sort of a growing sense of, my own opinion, which is that probably the most interesting thing you've done as leader was your move on the Senate early on. So I start to think maybe the narrative on Justin Trudeau going into election is less that he has traction on the economy and more that he has traction on democratic reform measures. Is it possible that maybe the center of gravity, if you will, in this campaign is shifting?
I don't think so. I think, first of all, Canadians want change. There's no question about it. And the question is going to be who represents the kind of change that they want. And that kind of change needs to understand the growth and the prosperity that we need to build. But it's also about approach. And for me, they go entirely together. An open, transparent government is a government that makes better decisions. One of the reasons this current government is stalled in terms of its growth rates is fumbling around without a plan on so many different levels is because they stopped talking to Canadians. They stopped listening to anyone other than their own narrow circles. And people are feeling like they are completely disconnected from the reality that people are living right now, which is why you get the Prime Minister talking about, wagging his finger at people and telling them, you never had it so good, you should be grateful for my leadership.
Do you not think that, sorry to interrupt, but do you not think that in a way the Conservatives are very good at connecting with people? Peter McKay's out today talking about drunk driving. I listened to messaging around parental benefits where they're very good at framing, look, here's a simple, direct thing that you're going to get every month. You listen to the messaging on the economy, and it's all often constructed around not sweeping grandiose plans, but fairly precise, targeted measures, regional development spending, an infrastructure project that they're going to be rolling out right before the election. People will see all this stuff being built with federal money. Isn't that actually showing an acumen for connecting with Canadians rather than a detachment?
No, it's not.
Why do you say that?
Because connecting with Canadians, and this is a teacher talking here, connecting with Canadians isn't about what you say. It's about what you're listening to.
Right.
It's about what you understand. And they are very capable of spinning a message and, putting up props and, getting the broadcast exactly targeted to exactly the segment they want. But they're not listening to Canadians. So there is yes, a government that messages very cleverly, but isn't listening, isn't drawing Canadians into the process. And that, at its heart, is the only way to create good governance in the 21st century.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes in conversation with Liberal leader Justin Trudeau.
This week, we learned of another senator who's facing serious allegations. But these ones are much different than the recent spending scandals. The Toronto Star reports that Senator Dawn Meredith had a 2-year sexual relationship with a teenaged girl. The paper says the relationship began when she was just 16 and the two met at a church event in Ottawa. She alleges they started with explicit online chats, but it then progressed to... kissing and sexual touching, and then after she turned 18, they had sex twice. Senator Meredith is married with two kids and is also an ordained Pentecostal pastor in Toronto. The age of consent in Canada is 16, but if one of the people involved is in a position of authority or trust, then the age is 18.
The news shocked many on Parliament Hill, and Meredith was quickly forced to leave the Conservative caucus. His colleagues, like Senator Vern White, who is a former police chief, didn't hold back in their thoughts about the allegations.
What's your reaction to the allegations?
I'm disgusted. I'm disgusted by what he's done.
Do you think he
should
step down?
Absolutely, he should step down.
Senator White was one of many calling for Meredith to resign. The Senate ethics officer has been asked to investigate the matter. Ottawa police won't say if they're investigating.
I was able to speak briefly with Liberal Senator Jim Munson in the foyer of the upper chamber. He gave me his thoughts on the story and the reputation of the Senate.
What was your reaction?
Well, normally I'm a person that believes in fairness and so on, and I still believe that way about people's lives. But if it's true, I was almost sick to my stomach. It's pretty serious business, isn't it? If this story is true. And it's the first time, which is rare for me, that I was lost for words, that I didn't quite know what to say. And I've been thinking about it all day. If this is true, he should do the honorable thing and resign from the Senate. Simple as that. But that's up to him. I know that the ethics officer is investigating this now, and that he's been removed from the Conservative caucus. And again, if this is true, what this report has said, it's pretty sick.
Obviously, stirring up a lot of emotions for you.
Well, you know, the Senate has gone through, a pretty rough time in the last month or so, and I think that there, a lot of us are emotionally fatigued, watching and witnessing what is, we've seen in the audit report, and we were facing that. The auditors talked about transformative change. We're facing that. We have, the majority senators seem to do fine. It was an expensive report, but I guess the money doesn't matter, and some alleged misspending of some money. So you go through those sort of things. You are trying to stand up and defend what we do here in our work and sober second thought and reviewing legislation. Bill 377, the union busting bill, is one of those. Mr. Mulcair doesn't like us, but the unions don't like this bill, and we don't like it either. So we're doing our jobs. So you're trying to keep your head high in terms of doing what you are appointed to do. And then you just sort of get these things, these sort of things have happened, and certainly doesn't make you feel very good.
Now, other senators say they want to wait for all the facts before passing any judgment. If the ethics officer does find any wrongdoing, then Senator Meredith could be suspended. I also want to add, none of these allegations have been proven yet, and I have tried calling and emailing Senator Meredith many times since the story broke. He has yet to answer or respond to any request.
Still to come on the show, we hold an exit interview with one of the 55 MPs retiring ahead of the fall election. We speak with Elections Canada about some big changes for voters, and the Macleans panel discusses the summer campaign and the details of the Macleans leaders debate.
Welcome back to Macleans on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Macleans Magazine.
Coming up on the show, Elections Canada is here to talk about the many changes of the fall vote that Canadians need to be aware of, and the Macleans panel talks about the Macleans leaders' debate and the summer campaign. But first,
the spring sitting of the House of Commons is now over. MPs adjourned on Friday, the last session in the House before the fall election. But the House rose on a day of a big departure. Industry Minister James Moore announced in a statement that he would not be seeking re-election in the fall. Moore is leaving federal politics after receiving some difficult health news about his son, so he wants to spend more time with his family in BC. Moore is the latest high-profile cabinet minister to bow out before the vote, following the departures of people like John Baird and Peter MacKay.
In fact, more than 50 sitting members of Parliament have announced they're not running again. Most of those are Conservatives who have been around since the Reform, Alliance, and PC days. One of those MPs is James Rajotte, who was first elected to the House of Commons in 2000 as the Canadian Alliance representative for Edmonton Southwest. Since coming to the House, Rajotte has gained respect from all parties. He's also become one of the longest-serving chairs of the Finance Committee. Rajotte sat down with Macleans political editor Paul Wells for an exit interview.
You've been here 15 years.
Yeah.
When you announced that you were going, a lot of people said, well, what a great guy, and Parliament will be the less without him. A lot of people said, it's got to be an expression of frustrating at never having gotten further. Is there any of that in the decision?
No, it's, frankly, I've loved my 15 years here. I've served 5.5 years in opposition, the rest of the time in the governing caucus, and I've chaired two committees, which frankly I've loved, and that's been my most rewarding part of my parliamentary experience here. I think, frankly, my temperament, I'm well suited to that role. You know, one can argue chairing finance, you have an awful lot of input into the budget, which is the primary document the government follows each and every year. So that role, I think I've had a lot of impact on public policy, which is why I ran, is you run because you love the country, but also because you want to have an impact on public policy. So I think I've certainly done that, both in my committee work, my private members' initiatives, working with other members on all sorts of efforts. So I think I've done and accomplished that, and so I have no regrets in terms of what position I may or may not have had, because the ones I had were very fulfilling for me.
And then the other thing people are saying is, and this isn't my phrasing, rats fleeing a sinking ship. We all saw what happened to the Conservatives in Alberta, and you're getting out while the getting is good. How would you respond to that kind of statement?
Well, I would say if you look at the polls, it's going to be a three-way competitive race this federal election. I mean, that's certainly what it's appearing to be. Mm-hmm. And in terms of where we are in the polls, frankly, I think we're at a very good number for a party that's been in power for nearly 10 years. And if you look at where we are now compared to 2011, 2008, 2006, so far, frankly, we're at a very good number, I would argue. If you look at the Alberta situation, I would point to a couple of differences. Firstly, the Conservative vote was split in the provincial election. It is united federally, I believe. And secondly is the Liberal Party in the provincial election was just not really on the radar map for voters at all. That's not true federally. Federally, the Liberals are definitely an option for some voters in Alberta. But as you know, Edmonton is a very politically dynamic city, and we've always had to fight for our seats there, and that's what we're going to have to do this election as well.
So the federal situation is almost the reverse of what just happened in provincially. The split on the left federally, whereas a split on the right provincially.
Yeah, exactly. And I think to a lot of conservative-minded voters who may have wanted a change, they got a change, they got a big change. Many of them got a bigger change than perhaps they wanted. So I think it's energized a lot of conservative voters. A lot of voters were contacting me and our organization and saying, like, I wasn't active in the provincial election, I want to be active in the federal one.
And what would you say people don't get about the Conservative Party in power? Or about this Prime Minister? What's the big misconception?
I don't know if it's a misconception, and it depends, because he has very strong supporters and he has detractors, as any political leader does. So I think the supporters understand his strengths. I think maybe I could answer in a different way and tell me whether I'm answering it, but I wish people could see how sort of thoughtful and in caucus, you'll raise an issue with him, and he will respond in a very substantive. It's clear he's thought the whole policy issue from A to Z back and forth, and he's analyzed every option, and he will explain why the government have come to the decision they did. And that's what, if we could somehow, you know, people who are detractors, if they could see that and how his mind works, I don't know how you actually allow them to see that. I mean, it's hard to, can you make the country the caucus room? Will they listen to a 20-minute discussion on that? It's difficult to say, but I wish people could see that side of him that we see every week in our caucus.
Okay. I'll bite. Why not? Why couldn't people see that? I don't mean every week in the caucus, but why couldn't he chat with me? Why couldn't, you know?
I think it's one thing I would say is that I would just give friendly advice to my colleagues on the conservative side is don't be afraid of communicating and explaining your rationale again and again as to why you're doing what you're doing. And I think they would argue they are doing that. But there's, you know, you have to understand, and we all have to understand, most people are not political animals. There's a certain percent of the population that is. So to get that kind of level of thought down to each and every person who's very busy, you know, raising their family or operating their business. So I would encourage the Prime Minister and others to keep showing that side of the government that, you know, on an issue, on a tough issue. We've thought about it, and this is why we've arrived at this decision. I think it would assist in terms of why we've come to the decision we have.
And did you ever wish that you had more latitude to speak your mind on issues?
I never felt actually controlled in that way. It was, I mean, this is a very partisan environment. I mean, I'm not an excessively partisan political figure, so I find that more disconcerting from all political parties, in the sense of, you know, you could disagree with someone, but let's not take it personal, and let's try to make it about the issue rather than about motive or that person's moral character. I think all political parties need to think hard about, you know, members can support a party 9 out of 10 times and still be strong members of that party. I would also say, if I could say very gently, I would like the media to think of members of parliament as something other than sheep or rebels. And, you know, you vote differently from the cabinet on two bills, private members' bills, and you're considered a rebel by the media, and that's not the it's not true at all. You're actually a strong member of your party, but you just may have a different, slightly different view on that specific issue, and there's no harm in that. And so I think that's where I'd like to get to and if you look at other parliamentary democracies in the UK, it's very much that case. British Tory and Labour MPs will often vote differently on non-core issues. I can understand if on issues like free trade or lowering taxes, if a conservative goes outside with that, that's not appropriate. But if a conservative or an NDP member wants to vote, if an NDP member wants to vote in the long gun registry, they should be able to do that. It should not be that they have to leave their political party because of that.
That was outgoing Conservative MP James Rajot in an exit interview with Maclean's political editor Paul Wells.
Still to come, we speak with Elections Canada about changes that voters need to know before they cast their ballots, and the Maclean's panel discusses the summer campaign and details about the Maclean's leaders' debate.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine. There are now less than 4 months to go until the federal election, but the 2015 vote isn't going to be like previous elections. From which riding you reside in to the documentation you need to cast a ballot, a lot of changes have been put in place.
Well, to speak more about what Canadians need to know before they cast their ballots, I'm joined on the phone by John Enright, a spokesperson with Elections Canada. First of all, we know that campaigns are basically run on cash, and Canadians can actually give more to their favorite party or even parties if they so wish. What has changed with donations?
Well, the donation caps, the limits have increased. So where previously it used to be $1,200 a year based on the categories, it's now up to $1,500 a year. So that's the individual limits for contributing to a party, a candidate, or a combination of leadership contestants, etc.
People, when they go to vote, they can't just sort of show up and say, I'm me, and cast my ballot anymore. When Canadians do go to the polling stations, what do they need?
Well, they need ID. You need a piece of ID pieces of ID that are going to prove your identity and address. So, for example, if you've got a government-issued piece that has your photo, your name, and your address, I'm thinking of a driver's license. Well, that would be the one piece. Not everybody drives, that's clear. So there's a combination of pieces that are listed on our website, and it's really quite comprehensive, and you can match those. The other change, however, is at the last general election, there was a procedure in place called vouching. That's been repealed under C-23, so vouching is no longer an option for electors. An elector who comes to the poll will still need to provide two pieces of ID, their identity, showing their name, but they can be attested to by an elector in the same electoral district who can attest to their residency.
And speaking of electoral districts, they've gone through a big change. I guess Canadians should really take a look at who represents them or what riding they're actually living in now.
Yeah, I think, well, Canadians are definitely going to see a change. We've increased, well, the electoral boundaries have shifted. There's more. Last general election, we had 308 electoral districts across the country. We've moved up to 338 now. So that's an increase of 30 seats across the country. But it's not limited to those 30 seats in terms of the changes. I mean, fully 87% of boundaries have changed across the country. Now, that could mean a line has shifted, you know, from a street corner to another, and it could be a more substantive change as well, in that you would not recognize the old electoral district within a new configuration.
And just one more question to ask you, and I know Elections Canada doesn't really want to get involved in political arguments or things like that, but recently there has been more talk about electoral reform, such as, yeah, you know, issues that have popped up in the past. It's nothing new. Mandatory voting is an option. Proportional representation is another, yeah, issue that's being brought up. Has Elections Canada prepared in any way, done studies to make sure that if any of these things were ever to, you know, be approved by Parliament, that you would be prepared for such options?
I mean, we're electoral administrators within a network of electoral administrators, both in the country and abroad. So we know, you know, other countries use PR. It's not new. We've seen it before. We know how it works. So we would follow the debates closely. If the chief electoral officer is invited to contribute to the debate, he will certainly do so. At the end of the day, Parliament will, you know, if the will of Parliament is to change the system and, for example, introduce proportional representation, then as administrators, we will apply that. Will there be challenges? Well, of course there'll be challenges, as with any sea change in any administrator's role, and in Elections Canada is no exception to that. We'd have to retrain our folks, for example. I mean, the ballot counting procedure will change significantly depending on the form of proportional representation adopted, if in fact it is adopted. So yeah, there would be changes on the administrator, but I mean, we would consult with Parliament. Parliament would indicate to us that it's the desire to proceed that way, and we'd let them know, hey, this is, you know, how we could do it, and we would support that. I mean, we're here to administer the Elections Act, no more, no less.
That was John Enright with Elections Canada discussing the many changes coming to the fall vote. It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined as always by my co-host Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's, and Maclean's Political Editor Paul Wells. Thanks very much for being here, guys. All right, the House has risen. The MPs are out of the House, out of Ottawa. They're going back home. And that's, you know, as some are saying, the unofficial start of the campaigning. But nonetheless, campaigning's going to kick into high gear now that they're all back in their ridings. And each party has its own unique issues that it's going to have to deal with, especially with the NDP up in the polls right now, the Liberals falling behind, the Conservatives trying to really get their message out there, as everybody is really right now. Aaron, we'll start with you. What do you think each party needs to do over the summer months before the writ is officially dropped?
Well, I think the Conservatives have to get back on off sort of the daily day-to-day concerns that are up in Parliament and get back on the economy. I think that's what they tend to do once Parliament is off. It wouldn't be surprising to me if their poll numbers come up a bit. Mulcair's challenge will be maintaining some visibility and prominence. He was up in QP every day, and that gave a pretty big platform for him. Trudeau, maybe this plays to his strengths, which is being out amongst the people and being impressive that way. I think now it'll be interesting to see whether how much longer the parties really want to hold their fire in terms of ads, in terms of really hitting the campaign trail, whether there's any gap or whether we just go into what is basically a several month campaign at this point. We really are going into it, I think, at this point with a three-way tie. Which is all the more incentive, basically, for every party to go as hard as possible.
And Paul, what are your thoughts on the summer campaigning?
It's a continuation of the spring and winter and fall campaigns. I mean, it's really striking to me that I haven't seen the Prime Minister appear in public without teleprompters, stereo microphones, and Conservative camera crews to capture everything he does. They've been campaigning for some time. Theoretically, things will now freeze in place for a while. That Parliament and the legislative process would kick up issues that would stand a good chance of moving support for parties around, getting people to give a party a second look and so on. Theoretically, that freezes in place until the formal campaign period in the fall. There'll be a few events, though, that will potentially mess up that equilibrium, and one of them, of course, is the Maclean's debate on August 6th in the dead of summer. But even though there's limited opportunity for the parties to really change the game, they need to stay in the game, and they're going to do that with campaign events, you know, all through the summer.
And I think you touched on it, Aaron, a little bit earlier, but controlling the message is a huge thing of these campaigns and getting out there to the people and trying to get across a message you're trying to get across. The fact that they're no longer in Parliament, will that give the parties more control over that?
It could. I think it's interesting, though, for the Conservatives that this news that we're getting now that Nigel Wright is going to be testifying in August, that could be a bit of a problem for the Conservatives. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. It'll be interesting also to see what the Conservatives have left to really sort of focus on. I don't know if they have many new things they can announce. Whereas the Liberals and the NDP will be able to conceivably start rolling out policy proposals that will maybe, you know, capture the attention and capture the news for a few days. So maybe that plays to the Liberal and NDP strength. But again, if the government doesn't have to deal with the day-to-day grief of question period in Parliament, they may have a pretty decent situation now to start dictating the terms of the debate.
And Paul, you did bring up the debate, and I wanted to focus on the debate. Macleans and Rogers had the big announcement this week that August 6th is the day. What other details can you tell us about the debate?
Going to be four party leaders participating. We are the only organization so far that has all four, and crucially, Stephen Harper and Justin Trudeau participating, along with Tom Mulcair and Elizabeth May. They're going to sit down with me in Toronto on August 6th, and I'm going to put questions on foreign policy, on the economy, on security, and on democracy and democratic institutions to all of the leaders, and they're going to get a chance to begin to make their case in a kind of a formal way to the Canadian people.
Right. And how do you think the debate could shift things? It will be the first debate, as you said, with all four leaders, major leaders, and we'll be, you know, watching and listening. It's going to be on many different platforms. Omni Radio is going to be streaming it, as well as City News, et cetera, Macleans. But how might that shift everything, Aaron?
There's always this debate about debates, which is whether or not they really shift things, whether, you know, people always kind of go in looking for the quote-unquote knockout punch. I think it is, in this case, fairly pivotal in that, A, we have three parties that have fairly decent odds of forming government after October. We have a prime minister who's very experienced in these situations. We have Tom Mulcair, who is supposed to be, this is supposed to be his strength. And we have Justin Trudeau, who this is supposed to be his great weakness. So I think it's a big test in that regard for the three leaders. Sometimes people try to discount these things and say that they're not the big deal. But I think if you go back and look at 2011, the real fall and decline of Michael Ignatieff began when Jack Layton beat him up in the debate. And I really do think in this case, when there's such a competitive balance, when the public really hasn't taken a decision yet on who they want to be prime minister, I think these debates are potentially far more important than even they have been in the past.
That's it for this week's episode. Remember to check out the Macleans pop culture podcast, The Thrill, and our podcast about books, Bibliopod.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.